Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
And a very happy Thursday to you. I'm really enjoying my Thursday, Jimmy. How are you enjoying your Thursday?
I'm enjoying it tomorrow because today's Wednesday.
Yeah, we're recording early. That's why no calls today. We are recording, in fact, on Wednesday. This is an open forum day, so even though it's Wednesday for us, it's Thursday if you're listening, and it's open forum.
Unless someone broke into the office and got the data file and is listening to it early.
They'd have to really do it before midnight tonight.
Really motivated fan.
But. Yeah. Why are you giving people ideas, Jimmy?
I'm sure it's
And that vault is impossible to break into. The vault where we keep the shows.
Guarded by a dragon.
So. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, is our guest this hour. And Jimmy, I am going to be tempted to give out the number. So if you hear me do that, please tell me to knock it off.
Because, okay.
It just becomes a habit and then I do it. And so we're taking all of our questions because we are actually recording live. And how to explain that? We are live.
We are not zombies.
No,
yes,
we're live and alive. But we are on Facebook Live, YouTube Live, and Periscope on Wednesday recording this. And so we will take questions from folks who are watching there. Again, open forum. So that means questions about any aspect of the Catholic faith, and callers or writers in this case do not have to be Catholic to ask a question. Jimmy, you ready to – shall I just give you a question?
Yeah.
All right. Robert on Facebook asks the following, Jimmy. When Jesus told St. Peter, "On this rock I will build my church," how was the word church understood by people at that time? Do you know of any pre-Christian use of the word translated as church?
Yes. So without going into the technical details or without going too far into them, the Greek word for church is ekklesia, and that means assembly. And so that word had a history in ordinary Greek. Whenever there would be an assembly of people, that word could be used to describe it. And so for the Greek readers of the gospel, Greek-speaking readers, that would have formed part of the background to how it was understood, the idea Jesus as the Messiah is creating a messianic assembly of people. There would have been some additional context for people who had a Jewish background. Now, the Gospels are written in Greek, but in all likelihood, this passage would have originally been spoken in Aramaic. Mm-hmm. And so it would have been informed by the Old Testament background that parallels this. In Hebrew, the word, if I'm not misremembering, for assembly is kahal. And it's used in the Old Testament to describe the community around Moses. So there would be a recognition that just like there was an assembly around Moses, there's going to be an assembly around Jesus as the Messiah. And you even have a kind of echo of that in the book of Acts. If you look at St. Stephen's speech before the Sanhedrin, right before they martyr him, he talks about the time when Moses was with the ecclesia in the desert, the church in the desert.
Okay.
And so there's a direct parallel made in Acts between the Old Testament community or assembly and the New Testament community or assembly. And so for an informed Greek speaker reading the Gospels or for a Jewish person hearing Jesus speak, you know, live or hearing the tradition recounted in Aramaic, that Old Testament background would have come to mind as well.
That's fascinating. I always think of ecclesia like it's almost like you know, in some New England towns they have direct democracy there, mm-hmm. and the whole town meets. That would be kind of an ecclesia, wouldn't it?
Well,
like what the Greek meaning was.
That would be an ecclesia, but because you'd have an assembly, but that would be a different kind of ecclesia than what the church is, because obviously there you have, you know, everybody is having a vote in what's going to happen, and that's not the way Jesus constituted his church.
Right. And that's even – so you see that even with Moses. It's constituted around God's chosen
– You have a lawgiver.
Lawgiver, prophet. Yeah. Yep. Well, I just want to share something with you. I don't know, maybe Nabil writes from mm-hmm. Pakistan.
Oh, cool.
And she says, you will be, or excuse me, I beg your pardon.
Nabil is a male name.
Yeah. You will be quite amazed to know that Catholic Answers Radio is quite popular among the Catholics here, meaning Pakistan.
Awesome.
Yeah. That's pretty cool, huh?
I recently got an email from a priest in Pakistan who just wanted to say hi and thank you. And I thanked him as well for his ministry.
Yeah, that's pretty. You've never been over there, have you?
I haven't been to Asia yet. The farthest east I've gotten is like Israel, but maybe someday.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we'll take a question then for. Let's go to. I got some questions here from Facebook. So, Jimmy, let's go to John mm-hmm. on Facebook. Do you think that people in purgatory are actually aware that that is where they are? Could it be that a person only is freed from purgatory when he is humbled enough to admit that that hell is where he deserves to be, but by God's grace,
he's not.
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting question. I would say that it's the kind of scenario that can be entertained in a fictional environment. There's lots of kind of creative ways to visualize purgatory in fiction, and including some major television shows of the last decade that will remain nameless because it's kind of a surprise.
That would be a spoiler.
Yeah, it'd be a spoiler.
Okay.
Is
it Seinfeld?
Well, that was purgatory for other reasons.
Oh, yeah.
However, there are lots of different imaginative ways of trying to think about the afterlife. An example that is, I think, kind of particularly neat is a book by C.S. Lewis called The Great Divorce, where it's actually about or involves people in hell, but they get to interact with people in other conditions. And so it's just one among many ways of trying to visualize how the afterlife might work. And I can imagine in a novel or a story, you know, thinking about, well, like, what if people in purgatory didn't realize they were in purgatory and then they have this realization and that's key to them getting out. And that's, you know, that's an interesting way to think about it. And it may reflect certain aspects of the truth. My suspicion, though, would be that that's not literally what happens. It might make for an entertaining and edifying story. And it might be an interesting way to think about it. But I would suspect that, you know, in the next life, we're going to have more rather than less knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And so my suspicion is that people in purgatory will know they're in purgatory. And they will know that that because of whatever mortal sins they committed, they deserved hell, but God has been merciful to them. I think they'll know that all the way through the experience of purgatory.
More knowledge, not less knowledge. That's
as a general principle. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry. I keep doing this. I lose my question.
Oh,
on
no.
you because the thing moves when you're watching it on YouTube.
Oh yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's a new thing. And I know Margot Basso is going to make fun of me for this because she teases me about that. I can't. So we'll go back to Facebook for a quick second.
Okay.
Robert. What is the level of culpability for someone who sins after being poorly counseled by a priest?
It's going to vary. It depends on a couple of things. Number one, it depends on the background knowledge level that a person had. So let's suppose I knew that, you know, that a particular action was sinful. I really know it. It's not something that that there's any dispute about. Let's say, just to pick a wild example, let's say murder. Okay, I know murder is a sin. Suppose I go to some priest who has been incredibly badly formed, and I'm using an extreme example, but
yeah.
Extreme examples help make points. And a priest tells me, oh, murder is not sinful. You don't have to worry about that. Well, okay, just because a priest told me murder is not sinful is not going to diminish my culpability because I know for a bunch of reasons, like it's in the Ten Commandments, it's clearly contrary to natural law, my own heart says murder is wrong. I've got bunches of strong reasons to say murder is a sin, but I wouldn't therefore be able to say, oh, well, a priest told me it's not, so I can kill anybody I want. You know, that wouldn't get me off the hook. On the other hand, if I don't have a lot of background knowledge in a particular area, or if the case I'm considering is very difficult, and a priest tells me, you know, you should act on this principle, either that it is or it is not sinful, then it can be reasonable to simply accept the priest's word, even if you're not sure, and say, you know, I don't know the answer on this one. It's ambiguous. It could go either way. And so I'm going to just trust that what the priest is telling me is right, even though I recognize it may not be. But as an act of submission to God, I'm going to go along with what his agent is telling me. And I will trust that if I'm wrong, and this is objectively sinful, that God will recognize the intent of my heart to submit to his will, even in situations where I'm not sure what his will is. Mm-hmm. And in that case, if the priest has told you the wrong thing, and it actually is objectively sinful, you won't be culpable for it because you don't know that it's sinful and you're sincerely trying to do God's will. You're just not sure what it is. So there's a spectrum between you don't get off the hook at all, or you could actually be pleasing God in a sense, even though what you're doing is wrong. You're not going to be culpable, and God will recognize the fact you're trying to please him.
Open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour, and I finally figured out how to make the YouTube thing stop bumping around. So
hey.
Sean on YouTube, watching on YouTube, asked the following question. Jimmy, what is the difference between a high mass, a low mass, and a solemn high mass, and is there a similar structure in the Novus Ordo?
So I'm not going to be able to answer this in detail because it gets into some technical issues involving the way the extraordinary rite was celebrated. And although I have some familiarity with that, I don't know the extraordinary form as well as I know the ordinary form. And so I don't want to commit to this is the answer when I'm not confident that I'm remembering everything correctly. So, but basically, as the terminology suggests, there are different levels of solemnity that are used. For example, the introduction of singing indicates a higher level of solemnity than just one without, say, a choir and one without musical accompaniment and so forth. And there are various options in the text of the extraordinary form, which as you trigger them, they increase the level of solemnity. The details, like I say, I'd have to go do some research to check just to verify my memory. There are equivalents to these that are used in the ordinary form of the Mass. Almost everything has an equivalent of some form or other. I mean, you know, you can use music, you can use an organ, you can use Gregorian chant, you can use incense. You have all of these as options, but the terminology is not used in the same way. So you don't, in the ordinary form, talk about a low Mass or a high Mass or things like that. Occasionally, you will find references to a pontifical Mass, which interestingly does not mean what you would think. What would you, Cy, think a pontifical Mass would be?
I'd think the Pope would come and celebrate Mass.
Yeah, well, that would be a pontifical Mass,
okay.
But a pontifical Mass does not require the Pope. It requires the bishop.
Oh.
And each bishop is, in a sense, a pontiff. They're not the Roman pontiff.
Oh, right.
But they are a pontiff. And so a Mass involving the bishop ends up being a pontifical Mass.
Got it. If I could just clarify, there's no qualitative difference in communion with Christ depending on
– It's a question of outward expression. But the fundamentals of the Mass are the same.
Open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. We're taking questions. We're pre-recording, so we're taking our questions from a live broadcast on Facebook Live, YouTube Live, and Periscope today. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here to tell you about the most exciting and innovative Catholic book in years. In today's world, people from countless perspectives pose challenges to our Catholic faith every day, in conversations, through the mass media, on the internet, and more on the infinite collection of social media platforms. There's no getting away from this daily onslaught. We as Catholics need to stand strong, to be prepared, to mount a daily defense, to respond to the many challenges that we, as believers, are presented with every day. To that end, my good friend and apologist extraordinaire Jimmy Akin has come up with what will surely be a great resource for years to come, a daily defense. A daily defense takes up a different challenge for every day of the year, 366 in all, teaching you how you can defend the faith and give answers to Catholics and skeptics alike. And it's user-friendly, with challenges and answers indexed alphabetically by scripture verses or by topic. So finding the answers can be quick and easy. Order your copy of A Daily Defense today by calling 1-888-291-8000, by visiting Catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hear it every year, the perennial question, what are you giving up for Lent? And there's nothing wrong with doing without certain things you may have an affinity for. But this year, why not turn the question around and ask, what are you taking on for Lent? If you don't have a daily time for reading the Bible, we recommend you make one. And to help you with those difficult passages, we also recommend a daily dose of Trent Horn's latest book, Hard Sayings, A Catholic Approach to Bible Difficulties. Hard Sayings is the perfect book for your Lenten journey. Trent looks at dozens of the most confounding passages in Scripture and offers clear, reasonable, and Catholic keys to unlocking their true meaning, deepening your understanding of God's Holy Word. Make this Lent one to remember. Order your copy of Hard Sayings today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open forum today. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, is our guest this hour. Open forum means we are taking questions on any aspect of the life or history or moral thinking of the Catholic Church, or actually any questions you've got of a religious nature. We're happy to take them. I'm not giving out the phone number only because at the, when being pre-recorded,
people would call and it would frustrate them because it would just ring and it wouldn't get picked up.
All right, unless they have one of those time phones where you can call back.
Superphone.
Is that what that's called?
Yeah. On Doctor Who, it's called the superphone.
And it can
call across time.
Oh, well, if you have a superphone, you're going to have to look up the number yourself.
I like a superphone. That would be cool. I'd also like psychic paper.
What's that?
Psychic paper?
Yeah.
It's a piece of paper, and you hold it up to somebody, and they see whatever you want them to see on it. So you can use it like as an ID to get in places.
Oh.
So it'd be tempting to like go to Area 51 and use psychic paper or something.
Yeah. I think you might be disappointed if you actually got into Area 51.
No, but still curious.
That'd be like going to a pontifical mass, and it's just the bishop. I hate to say that, but you know, it'd be kind of disappointing. Pope's not there. Brenda on YouTube writes the following, Jimmy. I recently saw a documentary film called Radical Grace. In it, a group of Catholic nuns claim that there were deaconesses and female bishops in the early church and that this is proof that the priesthood should be open to women. Is this accurate?
Well, we need to distinguish between the claim about female bishops and female deacons. In the case of female bishops, there have never been female bishops in the Catholic Church. There have been some heretical groups that would attempt to ordain women either to the priesthood or perhaps to the episcopacy, but these were not part of the Catholic Church. These were split off groups that had beliefs that contradicted, not just on this subject, but on other subjects as well, contradicted the substance of the Christian faith. So they were heretical groups. In terms of female deacons or deaconesses, there were individuals who were referred to as deaconesses in the early church. We even see an example of that in the book of Romans, because the letter carrier for the book of Romans was a woman named Phoebe, who was a deaconess from the port city of Corinth. It was a city I don't want to try pronouncing it off the top of my head without looking at the Greek spelling, but Corinth had is a slightly inland city. It had a port city, and so that was that was where Paul wrote the letter, and it got dispatched through the port, and this deaconess carried it, and Paul talks about her briefly in Romans and mentions her as a deaconess. And so we know that there were women called deaconesses. The question is, what was the nature of this? Because the whole term deacon in Greek, it's diakonos, originally it just meant servant. And so it wasn't a term connected with Christian ministry specifically at all. You could have servants who did all kinds of different things. Mm-hmm. They weren't necessarily religious servants. Same thing with the word minister, which you can also translate deacon as. It's like in England they have government ministers and they have a prime minister. Doesn't mean it's religious. The term deaconess could just mean a female servant. It could also refer to something that we know developed later on in church history, which is a kind of minor order, not a sacramental order, but a minor order that women could enter in order to perform certain spiritual functions that was called a deaconess. And it would typically involve ministry to women. Because there were situations where, for various reasons, some of them cultural, some of them other, it was appropriate to let women do what we today would call women's ministry in ministering to other women. This is particularly the case when you have things like baptism being performed naked. You know, was sometimes done. If you're a woman, you're going to get baptized and you're not going to have clothes on, you're probably going to want a deaconess to help you with that, mm-hmm. not a deacon. And so this office, though, was not ordained. And so it's kind of like the office of subdeacon. Subdeacon is a minor order. It's got the word deacon in it. And the subdeacons can perform some of the functions of deacons, but they're not actually ordained sacramentally. Mm-hmm. And that came home to me some time ago. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a priest in the Chaldean Rite, and he was telling me in his church we have 38 deacons. And I'm like, really? I mean, dude, you've got 38 deacons? And he's like, oh, no. They are all subdeacons.
Yeah, because right. That's like a translation to the language you're familiar with.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there was this office, this non-ordained office of deaconess. There have been claims that there were ordained deacons, but that's not the standard view in historical scholarship, because it's real clear when you look at some of the key authoritative passages that the female quote-unquote deaconesses were not ordained. For example, this is directly stated at the First Council of Nicaea. The First Council of Nicaea was held in the city of Nicaea in 325, and it gave us the first part of the Nicene Creed that we say every Sunday. But in addition to promulgating the first version of the Nicene Creed, it also promulgated a bunch of canons, little short statements dealing with matters of church discipline. And in those, it explicitly says that the women who are called deaconesses are not ordained. And so to just kind of sum up the answer, there were women in the early church called deaconesses, but it is not at all clear that they were ordained, and the evidence we have points in the other direction.
And there does seem to be a tendency to kind of almost make historical claims, just because I think many people don't know the ancient history, mm-hmm. or they don't know it's accessible. So, well, in the old, in the ancient church, they had this and they had that, but those aren't.
Well, people frequently will view history in the way that is convenient for the viewpoint they want to propose.
Right. And so – but Pope Francis, doesn't he have some kind of study group on deacons now or something?
Yeah, there's a commission that's looking at it right now, and it's reviewing it. It's unclear whether they're going to have any new findings, though.
Yeah, right.
Okay, open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We're taking all of our questions from Facebook Live, YouTube Live, or Periscope. More on that when we come back on Catholic Answers Live.
Bringing you the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here to remind you about a very special event that you're going to want to save the date for. This September 28th to the 30th, we'll be hosting our fourth annual National Apologetics Conference here in beautiful San Diego. And this is one conference you're not going to want to miss. The theme is the reunion of all Christians, and we've got an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to fire you up. Catholic historian Steve Weidenkopf, apologist Mark Brumley, apologist Devin Rose, plus all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. For almost four decades, Catholic Answers has been engaging our separated brethren in charity to bring them to the fullness of the truth. Join us this September for a lively and inspiring conference designed to help you play an active part in the reunion of all Christians. We've got lower prices than ever before and a beautiful venue in San Diego, California. You don't want to miss it. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today to register.
We hear it every year. The perennial question, what are you giving up for Lent? And there's nothing wrong with doing without certain things you may have an affinity for. But this year, why not turn the question around and ask, what are you taking on for Lent? Have you considered helping a friend or family member as they journey into the Catholic Church? It's called friendship evangelization. And so you don't have to go it alone, author Devin Rose has written Navigating the Tiber, How to Help Your Friends and Family Journey Toward the Catholic Faith. Not only does he equip you with the knowledge from Scripture, the early church, and Christian history, he shows you how to deal with the common aspects of a convert's journey. Make this Lent one to remember. Order your copy of Navigating the Tiber today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie, when were you tempted to say something but decided instead to bite your tongue? And maybe that kept you from hurting another person. Share your story with Jerry and Debbie tomorrow on EWTN Radio. Take Two with Jerry and Debbie airs weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific. And coming up right after Catholic Answers Live today, the world over with Raymond Arroyo. Interviews with newsmakers of interest to a Catholic audience right here on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks very much for being with us. It is open forum today, and our guest is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And we are taking all of our questions today from Facebook Live, YouTube Live, or, and I say from Periscope, but I haven't seen any questions yet from Periscope. I don't know if I'll be able to, so I don't want to give false advertising. But at the very least, to my knowledge, they're coming from Facebook Live and YouTube Live. And Jimmy, any questions you've got over there that from Facebook Live you want to get to, or shall I just
not
continue?
At the moment. Why don't you continue?
Okay. Nicholas. Jimmy, can you comment on the Protestant understanding? This is from Facebook Live. The Protestant mm-hmm. understanding of atonement, where they say the Father poured out his wrath upon Jesus in our place.
Okay. This is a view of, if for people who want to look this up online, let's say, this is a view that's called penal substitution. And it's a view that is common in some Protestant circles. It is particularly common in Calvinistic circles. And you hear this language used a good bit about God pouring out his wrath on Jesus. It is not the only view, even among Protestants, of how the atonement works. Mm-hmm. And there are others. One of the more famous ones in recent years is a view called Christus Victor, or Christ the Victor. And there's a famous book with that title written by Gustav Aulén, a Scandinavian scholar from the Protestant community who explored how that view is found in the Church Fathers. The difficulty with penal substitution is that there are sort of two difficulties. Number one, it's hard to find passages in Scripture that support it. There are some passages that are commonly appealed to by advocates of penal substitution. And sometimes they haven't really stopped to think about, does this passage really support penal substitution, or can it be taken in some other way? For example, there's a famous passage where Paul talks about how God made Jesus, who knew no sin, to be sin, that we might be the right, become the righteousness of God. Well, okay, so does it say anything in there about God pouring out his wrath on Jesus or punishing Jesus?
No.
And in fact, there are alternative translations of that, like God made Jesus to be, who knew no sin, to be a sin offering, which he was. And in fact, I think that's the primary New Testament understanding of the atonement, is Jesus is sacrificed. He's a sacrifice. But sacrificing something and punishing it are not the same thing. When you offer a sacrifice, you're offering a gift. And that may involve the death of the gift. But the idea of punishment is not essential to the idea of sacrifice. And, we see that, for example, because there are other sacrifices which are non-living, like, wave offerings or heave offerings or drink offerings in the Old Testament sacramental economy that don't involve any death. And even we ourselves, Paul in Romans talks about how we should present ourselves to God as living sacrifices. So obviously the idea of sacrifice doesn't entail the idea of punishment. And so the way to that Catholics generally look at Jesus' death is he offered his life in love for us to the Father, but he's not being punished by the Father there. Now, having said that, there are some Old Testament prophetic passages that you could look at that do use some punitive language, but there's a question of how literal are those. And one of the things that's a controlling factor in how literally they're to be taken is our knowledge of God, not just in terms of specific biblical texts, but our knowledge of God more broadly. One of the things we know about God is he's love. We're told that. We also know the Son is all holy. And we also know that punishing somebody who is innocent is immoral. And so if God is all holy, then whatever happened between the Father and the Son on the cross, the Father was not angry at the Son. I mean, why would he be? The Son is fulfilling the Father's will by going to the cross.
Right.
And so he's not angry, therefore he's not wrathful towards the Son, so he's not literally pouring out wrath on the Son. This is a transaction fundamentally of love, which corresponds to God's nature. And even if you want to poetically describe it in a way that could involve punishment, that's not literally what's happening here.
Open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Again, we are pre-recorded and all of our questions are coming from YouTube Live or Facebook Live. Thus far, Kim on YouTube asks the following, Jimmy: is there any historical evidence that the early church had a papacy?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's right there in the Gospels. You have Jesus telling Peter, "You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." That's giving him authority. Jesus then goes on to tell him that he's going to give him the keys to the kingdom, and whatever he binds on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever he looses on earth will be loosed in heaven. When you flip over to the Gospel of Luke and look at Luke 22, there's a dispute among the disciples about who's the greatest among them, and Jesus responds with a threefold statement. The first thing he does is he indicates the principle of leadership, that a leader needs to be a servant, not concerned about puffing himself up. And the second part of the statement is to say, don't worry, you're all going to sit on 12 thrones, so all of you are going to have leadership roles in the kingdom. And the third thing he says is, Peter, I've prayed for you specifically to strengthen the faith of your brothers. So he gives Peter a special pastoral role, even with respect to the other apostles. We also see that in John 21, where at the Sea of Galilee, Jesus asks Peter in front of the other disciples, do you love me more than these? And Peter says, yes. And Jesus says, then feed my sheep. So he's including the other disciples that he just referred to, more than these, among the sheep that Peter is to feed. So we have Peter being instituted by Jesus as the leader of the church in Jesus' absence once Jesus ascends to heaven, and that makes Peter the first pope. And if you then look at how the office of the papacy developed in subsequent history, it's a very easy line to trace. It's something that we have a lot of resources about at Catholic.com if you want to check it out. Also, my book, The Fathers Know Best, has multiple sections on different aspects of the papacy in the early church.
Thank you, Kim. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more on Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
We hear it every year, the perennial question, what are you giving up for Lent? And there's nothing wrong with doing without certain things you may have an affinity for. But this year, why not turn the question around and ask, what are you taking on for Lent? Did you know that by investing as little as 5 minutes a day, you can take on a Lenten practice that will both build up and inform your faith? A Daily Defense is the perfect book for your Lenten journey. Jimmy Akin takes up a different challenge for every day of the year, teaching you how you can defend the faith and give answers to Catholics and skeptics alike. And it's user-friendly, so finding the answers can be quick and easy. Make this Lent one to remember. Order your copy of A Daily Defense today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
St. Paul's street evangelization isn't like other evangelism you might have seen on the streets. We don't yell, and we don't force anyone to pay attention to us. Instead, St. Paul's street evangelization is committed to presenting a positive, passionately Catholic presence to a world hungry for truth. For more information, or to start a chapter of your own, go to www.streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com. It's time to do our part.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In John 8:51, Jesus announced that whoever keeps his word will never see death. The others responded, "Now we are sure you are possessed." They reminded him that Abraham and the prophets were already dead. "Are you greater than Abraham?" Jesus assured them, "Before Abraham came to be, I am." So they picked up stones to throw at him. To them, this was unspeakable blasphemy. Or, he was the unthinkable. He was God. It was unthinkable for them to consider that God would humble himself and visit them in such a way, let alone suffer and die as he was to do. For many, such a God is beyond them. God would never do such a thing, because if they were God, they wouldn't. But God is not merely a bigger version of us. Through our gift of faith, we know that he can love us that much, and on Good Friday he showed us that, in fact, he does. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum today. Unfortunately, not taking calls. If you have a call, you're going to have to hold that for tomorrow or another day. We do open forum at least twice a week, mm-hmm. Tuesdays and Thursdays, so we'll be here to do that again.
And we're doing something else today.
Oh, that's right. After this.
We're going to do a Catholic Answers More for people after just for folks who are watching us online.
Yep.
Right now, while we're taping this live, we're going to do a little post show.
And then don't you take the post shows and put them somewhere mm-hmm. where people can see them?
Yeah, I put them on my YouTube channel,
Which
is youtube.com/Jimmy Akin. Also, I put them on my blog, and Catholic Answers puts them on its YouTube channel as well, which is youtube.com/CatholicCom.
So you can catch that. Yeah. So if you're watching live now, we'll be here for a while after we finish the show today. And if you're not watching live, you can get that in those locations. Jimmy, on Facebook, Flo mm-hmm. asks, when referring to Jesus as the Son of Man, what is the Greek for of man? Someone once told me it should be read as the Son of God made man or flesh. Is that right?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I'd have to look it up. I don't have a Greek text in front of me, but I assume It's anthropou, which would be it could be andrew, but I'm guessing it would be anthropou, which is anthropos is the more normal word. We translate it in English as man, although it really can mean man or woman.
Mm-hmm.
Of man is going to be in the genitive case in Greek. It's a very straightforward thing. Typically what happens is you take the dictionary form of the word, in this case anthropos, you knock off the os and you put on an oo. And so anthropou would be of man. It's going to be either that or something very similar to it. And the person who suggested that it should be something like son of God made man or made flesh or something, that person is theologizing. They're reading the language through a theological lens. They're not translating the language.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that it's true that Jesus is the son of God made man or made flesh, but that's not what the title son of man means.
And does anyone else refer to Jesus as Son of Man, or is it just himself that refers
to
himself that way?
Actually, the title predates Jesus because it's used in the book of Daniel. Mm-hmm. It's also used for a celestial kind of messianic figure. It's also used for a celestial messianic figure in the book of First Enoch. And so this is a concept that there was going to be this heavenly Messiah-type figure known as the Son of Man who would be coming. It's also used in other contexts in the Old Testament, and in those it tends to just mean human. So like Ezekiel is addressed at one point as Son of Man, just meaning you're a human, is an angel is talking to him.
Yeah.
So,
right.
You know, it's like, so you're just a son of a man.
Mm-hmm.
It does have this special kind of celestial messianic significance in Daniel and in First Enoch, and that seems to be the background that Jesus is drawing on in his application of the term to himself. And then, of course, from Jesus using it, it gets picked up by other people, and it's been used all the way down through church history.
Also coming from YouTube, Ashwith. Jimmy, I have Protestant relatives who say that we could be affected by the sins of our ancestors and also by curses that people speak against us. What is the Catholic perspective?
Well, the Catholic Church does not have any teaching supporting the idea that the sins of our ancestors affect us in any supernatural way. Now, obviously, if our ancestors have sinned, that can affect us, just like our sins can affect other people. But but in terms of how that happens, well, I can imagine some scenarios. If let's say you've got an ancestor who was really rich but then gambles it all away and you're born in poverty as a result, well, obviously his sin of excessive gambling resulted in you being affected. Similarly, if you watch the opening credits in The Simpsons, you see Homer driving home with a glowing green radioactive rod he's been playing with. Well, that's gonna affect his genes and could lead to genetic defects in his children, which could explain a few things, like the fact they never age.
Right.
You know,
oh, that's certainly they're preserved by the radioactivity.
It's possible to cite a real world example. Obviously, sometimes mothers use drugs or take substances that can interfere with the development of their children. And so in natural ways, our ancestors' sins can affect us, but the church does not have any teaching that there's any kind of supernatural, mystical passing down of sin. There are some people who've speculated about that, but they're not supported by the magisterium. In terms of curses, similarly, we don't have magisterial support for the idea that if someone curses us, that anything bad is going to happen. If that were something that was a practical thing, then one, we would know about it because it would show up in people would be doing it and it would be effective and
yeah.
it would become an established pattern and the magisterium would have commented about it. But the fact that the magisterium hasn't commented about it and the fact that people aren't using curses all the time against each other suggests that this is an inefficient, ineffective, superstitious practice.
I'm glad to hear it because I do think there might be some people who would try it on me. Falco on YouTube. Oh, by the way, congratulations on working The Simpsons in to a question about sin. That was
that's pretty good. Oh, well, thank you. Not too hard, actually.
I kind of was like, wait, where are we going with this? Yeah. Falco on YouTube has a multi-part question, but I just want to give you one part, Jimmy. Is it true that the Old Testament promotes slavery?
No, it doesn't promote slavery. It recognizes that slavery is a bad thing, that it's not necessarily in the sense of a moral evil, but a disadvantaged condition. Because one of the things that Israel is reminded of is how they were slaves in Egypt.
Yeah.
And that was viewed as not a good thing for them. They were in a disadvantaged condition in Egypt because they were slaves. Everybody, obviously, if you have a choice between being a slave and being a freeman, you want to be a freeman. So everybody in the ancient world recognized that slavery is a disadvantaged condition, including the people of Israel. And precisely because they had been slaves in Egypt, they are exhorted to be charitable and kind to slaves because that's in their history too. And so it doesn't promote slavery. Now, it does tolerate slavery, and it even has some regulations regarding slavery. In particular, it tries to protect slaves from being fundamentally harmed by their masters. For example, if you had a slave and you knocked out his tooth, you had to let him free.
Oh.
Yeah. Similarly, slaves in many situations could only serve for a limited time. And at the arrival of the Sabbath year or the Jubilee year, you had to let them go unless they voluntarily chose to stay. And so this was just a part of their society. And frankly, slavery has been part of virtually every society in human history. It's actually been quite recent, that we've been blessed to live in a world where slavery is not a common experience in society. But it was part of ancient culture, and it was recognized as an unfortunate disadvantaged condition. But people in the ancient world didn't see a way to eliminate it effectively from society, and consequently, it's tolerated, but it's not presented as a good thing in Scripture. And it's kind of similar to situations today where the church would like to change things, but there's no practical way to do it, like totally get rid of abortion overnight.
Yes.
There's no way to do that practically. We want to work towards that goal, but there's no practical way to just snap our fingers and have it be eliminated overnight. I wish there was. It's a similar situation with slavery. It was a disadvantaged condition. If you asked someone in the ancient world, wouldn't it be great if everybody could be freemen and we could still have society working and functioning and people would be prosperous and so forth? They would have said, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't see a way to practically do that, and it took many centuries actually for that kind of situation to develop. But fortunately, it has, and in most of the world today, slavery is illegal, though there are some places where it has yet to be stamped out.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I got to look that up after the show.
There are a few. Yeah. And even in places where it is illegal, it still can happen.
Yeah, now that I realized that but I didn't realize there was still legal slavery. But
in a few places.
Oh, yeah. Guest, I'm assuming this is not the person's real name. Guest asks, Jimmy, and this is from YouTube Live, does the church teach that the Gospels were written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John?
No. The church teaches that they're divinely inspired and that they had divinely inspired authors. But precisely who those authors were is something that is regarded by the church as a matter of history rather than a matter of faith. And so even though we refer to them by their common historical titles, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the church doesn't teach that those individuals were necessarily the inspired authors who wrote them. Having said that, I think they were. I think the evidence supports that Matthew wrote Matthew. I think it supports that Mark wrote Mark. I think it supports that Luke wrote Luke. And I think it supports that someone named John wrote John, although there's more of a discussion in that case of which John was it. But if you want to read more about that, I suggest checking out my book, A Daily Defense, where I go into a lot of information about who wrote the Gospels and what significance it has, and also when they were written, because I also think they were written quite early. And I lay out the evidence for that in that book. Also, I have a DVD called Why You Can Trust the Gospels, and that could be another good resource for you.
And that's an important thing because, just the Why You Can Trust the Gospels thing, many people, I think without thinking about it maybe, that the Gospels are a myth or they're a mythologized history. And they're not.
Right. And that's what I go into in my DVD. I start with the top level of, you know, can we verify even basic things like did Jesus exist? And then I move down a step to, okay, let's look at a more detailed level. How reliable are they as witnesses to Jesus's teachings and his life? And then I go down to the detail level and show that even tiny little details that people never notice fit together from the different Gospels.
I think we can get one real quick question in here. I hope it's quick. Does the church, this is from Auchiwawa on YouTube Live. Does the Catholic Church have a teaching on the meaning of death in Genesis? I've heard some people claim it is only referring to spiritual death.
Okay. So the motive for the question is the fact that God tells Adam and Eve, in the day you eat of this fruit, you're going to die. But then they don't die for a long time after that.
Right.
So I assume that's the background to the question. And one way of dealing with that would be to say, well, Adam did die that very day spiritually, but not literally. But that doesn't exhaust – even if you take that interpretation, it doesn't exhaust the meaning of death because Adam and Eve later did die in another sense.
Right.
So death is more than just spiritual death. However, that's not the only option because in terms of how to interpret that that verse. You could say God had mercy on him. And so so they didn't die. You could also say, and this is the view that I tend to incline towards, that in the day you eat of it, you will die just means when. So in the time period you eat of it, it's not literally the Hebrew word yom can mean either a 24-hour period, a day in that sense, or it can mean just a general time frame. Like if I were to say back in Napoleon's day. Well, there wasn't a 24-hour day that Napoleon had. I'm referring to a general time period. And in the same way, in the day you eat of it just means when you eat of it, in the time period you eat of it, after you eat of it, you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the interpretation that I tend to have. There's no official interpretation here that the church has, but those are some options.
Okay. And So we do have record that Adam's death. I mean, that's
it's noted in Genesis 5.
And we don't Eve is just not mentioned, but she
her death I don't believe is mentioned now.
Yeah, but Jimmy Akin, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It was fun doing just was it fun for you? YouTube questions and
always
Facebook
fun.
Live. It's nice to get to all those questions.
And we're going
to
do some more on.
Right, and we'll
Catholic
visit with people
more.
And all that. Right, so we will. We are. If you're listening on Thursday, we'll see you again tomorrow on Friday. If you're watching on Wednesday, we'll still be with you right after this on Catholic Answers Live.